Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood. And this week, I'm going to be talking about one of my clients' projects, actually. I took over a project from Pivotal Labs. I actually took it over from another guy who took it over from Pivotal Labs. But anyway, the idea is that I had to dig in pretty deep to the way they had their JavaScript set up, and I learned a little bit from it, and so I'm going to share some of the lessons there. There were some things that I liked. There were some things that I didn't particularly like. So I'm really looking forward to jumping in and getting, you know, talking about some of the stuff that was there. But before we get started, I need to mention that we are sponsored by New Relic. New Relic RPM is a terrific application management tool. I actually used them to on this client's project to optimize the project quite a bit, and I wound up getting a lot of the response times down by half or better. Just working through some of the stuff. So the average response time on their website was like 2,500 milliseconds or 2.5 seconds. And I got the average response time down to 900 milliseconds, which isn't too bad considering that the thing that's pulling it up are these weird edge cases where if you download the calendar from their website, it takes like 50 odd seconds. It takes almost a full minute to compile all that and then pull it into your calendar. And that's what's throwing it off, and it's throwing it off big time. Without those, I bet the average response time would be down in the 500 or 600 millisecond range. So anyway, they're a terrific tool. You can get them at newrelic.com. You can also find them at teachmetocode.com/newrelic. All right, well, let's get into this and then talk about some of the stuff that's here, because, you know, there's a lot to cover, and I'm really kind of excited. So anyway, this client had Pivotal Labs build this website, and I'm not going to disclose what website it is. I may have mentioned it before. You may know who it is, but I don't know. I feel like I might be involving them without their permission. I don't think that Pivotal Labs will mind if I'm mentioning it, especially since generally I have very good things to say about the way they have things set up. So anyway, they finish the project, and then usually what they do is they'll finish it and then they'll pass it off so that somebody else can maintain it. And then so that's what they did. They finished it off. They helped helped this company find a developer to help them maintain it, and he helped them for a year or so. And then they brought me on, and I kind of took over from him. And anyway, last week I had to deal with basically posting some information to their website. They wanted to change the way some of that worked. And so I had to get in, and I spent about 2 days wading through JavaScript code, figuring out what was going on there so that I could make that functionality perform like the rest of the functionality that's there on that same page. So I was digging in, and I found all of this interesting stuff about the way that they have it set up. So the first thing that I want to jump in on is Jelly. And Jelly is actually, I think you can get it as a Ruby gem, but it is a jQuery extension to, let's see, Jelly. I didn't even look it up. So I'll pull it up here. Anyway, so basically what it is it's a library written by Pivotal Labs. And what it does is, well, what they're using is they're using it where for the Ajax calls is really where I was dealing with it. So they have Ajax with Jelly, and then what that does is it actually does the Ajax call to the server, which is running Rails. And then from Rails can actually send a response back, and the response is actually structured in such a way to where the response will come back, and then there's a callback on Jelly that will trigger an event that then triggers another callback on whatever it is that you use that on. And you can trigger any callback you want on any Jelly-enabled kind of class or object. So basically then it triggers that callback and then does whatever it needs to do. So in their case, I was adding through Ajax basically credits, you know, so you could see who the author was or whatever of the information being posted. And when it posted that information, then it would do a callback and it would send back the HTML that needed to be appended to the list of credits on the story. And so anyway, it was really interesting to see how that worked because it was actually very, very clean and convenient. And it makes it really easy for you to send messages back and forth between the server and the client. And anyway, I was really, really impressed because effectively then you know, in your controller, you just say, I think it's Jelly callback. You tell it which handler, you tell it how that handler is namespaced, and then you give it the information to send back, and it just turns around and does it. And wow, it was really, really slick. And so that was one thing that I thought was really convenient, because usually what happens is you set up an asynchronous callback on success for your AJAX call in JavaScript or in jQuery, but it's not as clean, and you don't have that level of control as you do sending the message to the server and getting a message back. One other thing that I noticed was, and I'm sure that they're just, you know, tailoring the callback to work in that particular way. Because I can already think of how you would structure it to basically do that. You just send back a formatted response in JSON and have it pick it apart. But to have it built in so you don't have to think about it is really convenient. One other thing that I noticed a lot of was namespacing. And the namespacing, everything was spaced, namespaced basically under the code name for this website. So they had their own code name for the website that wasn't actually the domain of the website. And anyway, everything was namespaced under that. So you would have, the project name. And then the next namespacing would usually be like a controller name or some kind of functionality namespace. And so you would get like the function name. And then I was working in the user stories controller. And so you'd have project name, user stories dot, and then whatever functionality. And the interesting thing was that then you get into when all the JavaScript would load, it would notice that it was in the user story controller in the edit action, which is where I was working. And so then it would know that it needed to call the edit function under the user stories namespace, and it would turn around and actually just run it. And when it ran it, it would initialize all of the stuff that it needed. They also namespaced a lot of stuff for different widgets that showed up on the different pages. And so it would actually initialize, it would call the init methods under the namespaces for each of the widgets and set all that up, and it would set up functionality under a lot of the other stuff and set variables and the whole nine yards. And it was really interesting the way that they structured that so that you could effectively have a custom setup for each page and make it work in the way that you wanted it to, which, you know, I was really, really happy with once I figured it out. The last thing that I noticed was that they did all the JavaScript loading at the end of the page. Well, not all, but most. And they were literally loading like between 50 and 100 files easily, JavaScript files from various places, you know, both within the app and outside, you know, like Facebook and stuff. And, you know, fascinating, what they did is they actually had a helper, an application helper, and they appended all the file names to an array, and then they literally would just call JavaScript include tag and then give it that array, and it would go through and it would include each and every one of those files. And the amazing thing was that, you know, if you load all your JavaScript at the end of the file, then it speeds things up because it loads your DOM and then it loads the JavaScript, and then all the effects from the JavaScript take effect, which you can actually see as the page loads. It actually loads it in, you know, in the raw HTML. I mean, you can see it, and then everything kind of formats because they're using the KUFON YUI stuff to do the fonts and things. And so you see the fonts kind of sharpen up and switch to the fonts that they're supposed to be and things like that. And really, really interesting way of doing things. But at the same time, you know, it speeds things up. And if you're including that many JavaScript files, it's probably a good idea, a good way to go. And so, you know, fascinating how you can do that and put that at the end of the file. Now, there were a few problems with the way that they had done this, and the biggest thing really was that it was hard for me to find things initially. Now that I know where I'm looking, it makes a lot of sense. And so for them, I'm sure it makes a ton of sense, because effectively they have all of these different developers working on all of these different projects. And if they all follow the same convention, then they know where to look. They know where this stuff is. And now that I understand the convention, I can also go and find things more easily, because I have a better idea of where all of this stuff belongs. But initially, finding it all, I mean, literally, it took me 2 days. I have most of the functionality for that feature done, but it took me 2 days to get that far and to figure out where all of the JavaScript was. So a little bit of documentation here or there saying this is generally what we did and this is where you can find stuff. And I'd had to deal with some of it before, but I just kind of hacked around it for the most part. And, not really bypassing this actual functionality, but I would find where it goes and just stick it in and it would work. And I never really figured out where it had to go, because I didn't have to get in that deeply. I mean, worst case scenario, I mean, I would have to get in and initialize something that was already there. But in this case, I was actually modifying some of the stuff that was already there, and then initializing new pieces that I was adding in. And so I had to get a little more involved in the way that the framework was set up. And, it's just been really interesting to see how they did it. They have done a few other things like that in their Ruby code as well, including different modules and things like that. And I've had to deal with some of that, but not a ton. Mainly because most of the changes that the client wants are pretty superficial. I mean, every once in a while they want some deep functionality changes, and so I have to check that out. But the other thing that's really nice about getting a Pivotal Labs project and maintaining it is that they have all the tests in there to begin with. So as long as you maintain all the tests, write tests for the new stuff that you add, then you have full test coverage to go ahead and work with stuff. And you figure out pretty quickly if you broke something. And I've had those save me a few times. So anyway, that's all I really have to say about it. It's just been a really interesting project to work on. I generally like working on new projects as opposed to maintaining existing projects, but this has been kind of an interesting learning experience. And, the other thing is that I just want to point out that if you become frustrated with something that isn't like the standard way that you do things, and my standard JavaScript setup is dump it all in public JavaScripts and then ignore it, which isn't the right way to do it. They've actually set up folder structures and namespaces and the whole nine yards to make it work, and that's, it seems like that's a much better way to do it. The only thing is then you need to be able to explain to people, this is where this lives, this is how this works, this is how we're approaching it, these are the critical pieces for it, and then you can kind of move ahead from there, especially if you're building something with a point in mind of handing it off to somebody else eventually and making them work on it. And a lot of this stuff, I think it conforms a lot to what we were talking about in last week's Ruby Rogues podcast, where we were talking about beautiful code. So if you want to get into kind of a more, it's not as concrete. We don't give specific examples as much. In fact, we used a lot of metaphors to talk about beautiful code. But it was an interesting conversation. And so if you're interested in knowing about that, then go over to rubyrogues.com. And check out the podcast, and I'll put a link to it here in the show notes so that you can go and look at it. And that's about it. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up. And I just want to thank you again for listening to the podcast. I want to thank New Relic again for sponsoring the podcast. If you're interested in sponsoring this or any of my other podcasts, you can contact me, chuck@teachmetocode.com. I'm also available for one-on-one coaching and for custom Ruby or Rails or Sinatra or whatever, what have you, and any of that. If you need custom code written, a custom application built, I'm definitely open to that. I've to date built 1.5 social networks. Well, I guess I can count the other one as social network. That portion of it's done. It's just adding functionality for the client. So anyway, if you need any of that done, go check it out. Two other items. I am working on a Ruby on Rails summer camp. It will be starting in about 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks. Go over to teachmetocodeacademy.com and check it out. You can sign up. It's $497. It's an 8-week course. I'm doing webinars every week. And, you know, hopefully that'll get you going, get you started. The other thing is I'm working on a membership site. The idea is that, you know, I was wishing for a long time that I had a website that would, you know, go into Ruby tips, Rails tips, dig into the Ruby on Rails code and see what that's all about. And, you know, maybe get into some of these technologies that people are talking about. And so I've set up my own membership site. It's $9 a month. It's a great way to support the podcast. And as soon as I have that up there, I'm actually going to post to the mailing list, let those people sign up first, and then I'll open it up to the general public. So if you want to get news on that, then sign up for the mailing list. You can do that at teachmetocode.com. It's over in the sidebar on the right. And that's all I have. Again, I want to thank you for listening to the Teach Me to Code podcast. And remember that writing the code is the easy part.